Thank you for downloading from Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Support for this podcast comes from your generous gifts and donations. You can find out more about Ravi Zacharias and the team at www.rzim.org.
We must concede that there are real horrors done in the name of Christ, but on the other hand, we must also point out that there are gross exaggerations in the retelling of this story that shores up the current paradigm.
Have you ever heard the claim that Christianity is responsible for all or most wars in history? There are many who make that statement. The problem is, it's not true. Hello and welcome to Let My People Think, where this week Dr. John Dixon is filling in for Ravi Zacharias. This week Dr. Dixon continues his message on violence in the Old Testament. Unfortunately, there are stories of terrible violence in both the Bible and church history, but critics have used those to derive false generalizations about the Christian worldview. What is the full history of violence in the Christian faith? And what is the real truth that should be drawn from our scarred past? Here's Dr. Dixon as he responds to claims about violence in Christianity.
And my lunchtime friend would have found great comfort in a three-part series that showed on Australian television recently. Have you seen this one, The Secrets of the Inquisition? Beautifully shot. Terrible. Here the church is presented as doing nothing but torturing, raping, pillaging, mass murdering through the 350-year Spanish Inquisition. And as I was preparing this material, the major Australian newspaper, The Sunday Age, offered this stunning piece of secularist apologetics. "The question I can't escape," says Michael Coulter, who's one of the editors of the newspaper, "is why so many people clearly prefer the realm of faith, the realm of Inquisition and violent jihad, to the realm of thought." In my view, thought actually isn't the secularist's best friend on this particular issue. The religion leads to violence mantra has become a truism in our culture, mainly because fascinating people, popular books, and high production documentaries have said it so often, it's true now. But it isn't true. Not in the blanket sense that's often intended. What can we say? I think there are a few things we can go on the front foot with. But first, we need to go on the back foot and concede a partial truth. I doubt you will find any Christian today who is not rightly and deeply ashamed of the Inquisition, the Crusades, and so on. We concede that these are terrible departures from the faith. We confess it. Secondly, that said, retellings of these stories of violence frequently involve gross exaggerations. Can I introduce you to a stunning new book by David Bentley Hart, a patristics scholar, Greek Orthodox believer, and philosopher. It is a most powerful answer to the claim that Christianity has just raped and pillaged through history. And one very persuasive argument he makes in the book is that every new era tends to retell stories about the era it replaces by exaggerating the evils of that era, so as to present itself as the great deliverer, as the bringer of special freedoms. This requires exaggerations. We do this about the 1950s in a small way. We do it about the Puritans or Victorian England. The Enlightenment figures, the famous Enlightenment figures, did it about the so-called Dark Ages. In fact, they coined a phrase that scholars no longer use, Dark Ages. Historians don't use that. Here's Bentley Hart in full flight. "Hence modernity's first great attempt to define itself, an age of reason, emerging from and overthrowing an age of faith. Behind this definition lay a simple but thoroughly enchanting tale. Once upon a time, it went, Western humanity was the cosseted and incurious ward of Mother Church. During this age of faith, culture stagnated, science languished, wars of religion were routinely waged, witches were burned by inquisitors, and Western humanity labored in brutish subjugation to dogma, superstition, and the unholy alliance of church and state. All was darkness. Then in the wake of the wars of religion that had torn Christendom apart came the full flowering of the Enlightenment, and with it the reign of reason and progress, the riches of scientific achievement and political liberty, and a new and revolutionary sense of human dignity. The secular nation-state arose, reduced religion to an establishment of the state, or in the course of time to something altogether separate from the state, and thereby rescued Western humanity from the blood-steeped intolerance of religion. Now at last, Western humanity has left its non-age and attained to its majority in science, politics, and ethics. The story of the travails of Galileo almost invariably occupies an honored place in this narrative as exemplary of the natural relation between faith and reason, and as an exquisite epitome of scientific reason's mighty struggle during the early modern period to free itself from the tyranny of religion. This is, as I say, a simple and enchanting tale, easily followed and utterly captivating in its explanatory tidiness. Its sole defect is that it happens to be false in every identifiable detail. This tale of the birth of the modern world has largely disappeared from respectable academic literature and survives now principally at the level of folklore, intellectual journalism, and vulgar legend. Lies and exaggerations about the past shore up a new paradigm sense of self. If I had time, I'd give you a lovely quote from G.K. Chesterton from the book Orthodoxy. I just turn you to page 106, 107, basically saying the same thing. But let me give you some examples of the exaggerations of this story. If you want great detail, go to Bentley Hart. It is truly a stunning book. It is estimated by historians that the Spanish Inquisition killed approximately 5,000 to 6,000 people over its 350-year period. 5,000 to 6,000 over 350 years. I have this on the authority of Edward Peters, professor at Pennsylvania University, one of the leading scholars of the Crusades and the Inquisition and so on, and I believe not a believer. The point is, that's fewer than 18 people a year killed in the Inquisition. Now, one a year is too many, right? But it hardly sustains the monstrous narratives you often hear. Take the Northern Ireland Troubles. Let's concede that they were, at their heart, religious troubles. Having been to Belfast, I keep meeting people who tell me they weren't actually religious troubles. But let's concede that it is. It is widely accepted that the troubles caused the deaths of about 3,500 people over a 30-year period. Again, one death in the name of Christ is a blasphemy. But the iconic status of these two evils of Christendom, the Inquisitions and Northern Ireland, far exceeds the reality. Yet, listen to Peter Watson, the author of Ideas, A History of Thought and Invention. He was, in the New York Times, asked the question, what's humanity's worst invention? He replied, without question, ethical monotheism. This has been responsible for most of the wars and bigotry in history. To which David Bentley Hart in Atheist Delusions replies in characteristic style, the pagan rhetorician Libanius justly bragged that the gods of the Roman Empire had directed the waging of innumerable wars. By contrast, the number of wars that one could plausibly say have actually been fought on behalf of anything we might call ethical monotheism is so vanishingly small that such wars certainly qualify as exceptions to the historical rule. Bigotry and religious persecution, moreover, are anything but peculiar to monotheistic cultures, as anyone with a respectable grasp of human culture and history should know. And yet, absurd as it is, Watson's is the sort of remark that sets many heads sagely nodding in recognition of what seems an undeniable truth. Such sentiments have become so much a part of the conventional grammar of enlightened skepticism that they are scarcely ever subjected to serious scrutiny. We must concede that there are real horrors done in the name of Christ, but on the other hand, we must also point out that there are gross exaggerations in the retelling of this story that shores up the current paradigm. Thirdly, It is naive and dogmatic for our critics not to admit the great good done in Christ's name throughout history. It is one of the seriously frustrating things of reading Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great. He concedes nothing of the good done in the name of Christ. This relentless story after story of the evils of Christendom. I always think you should be suspicious of an argument that can't generously concede. We should therefore feel no embarrassment about saying something of the glorious good the church has brought into the world. Let's start with the ancient church. A fact. The first international aid project in world history was Paul's decade-long collection for the famine-ravaged people in Palestine. The early church inherited the Jewish welfare model, but instantly said it was open to believer and unbeliever alike. This was a novelty in antiquity. In the year 250, the church in Rome was daily supporting 1,500 destitute people on a huge food roster. By the 4th century, the pagan emperor Julian became so worried that the Christians were going to take over the world by the stealth of good deeds that he started writing to the pagan priests around the empire to say, quick, beat the Christians at their own game. And here's his letter to a priest. For when it came about that the poor were neglected and overlooked by the pagan priests, then I think those impious Galileans observed this fact and devoted themselves to philanthropy. The Galileans also begin with their so-called love feast, open meals, or hospitality or service of tables, for they have many ways of carrying it out, and hence they call it by many names, and as a result they have led very many into this atheism. Christianity was called atheism because it denied the Greek gods. And what about this? It is disgraceful that the impious Galileans support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men can see that our people lack aid from us. Moving to the modern period. Friends, we need to bone up on our history of the end of slavery in the British realm, or Lord Shaftesbury's efforts on behalf of the marginalised and the poor, or of course your history of Martin Luther King on behalf of the civil rights movement, or the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa led by Desmond Tutu, all profoundly Christian movements. And even today, most non-government aid in the Western world is serviced through Christian agencies. This is true even in pagan Australia. Here's a quotation from a government report on research and philanthropy in Australia from 2004 by the Department of Families, Community Services and Indigenous Affairs. Basically, the whole report found stunningly a huge correlation between religious activity and philanthropy and volunteering. I'm sure it's the case in the US, but you need to find your own figures. I tried to do some digging, but I wasn't sure that I had reliable enough figures to bring it to you. But so, you should be doing this. You need to have these up your sleeve. This, friends, doesn't make Christians better than secularists. That's not what I'm saying, and don't please ever sound like you're saying that. But it does belie the claim that we are worse. And that is certainly what is being claimed at the moment. That we are worse, that we poison everything, that we are root of all evil. Fourthly, the elephant in the atheist's room, of course, is that there have only been three, maybe four, formerly atheistic regimes in world history: Stalin, Mao, and Pol Pot. And let's be frank, they weren't improvements. Stalin's openly and ideologically atheistic project killed 20 million people. That's more people each week than the Spanish Inquisition did in its 350-year history. The figures for Mao aren't reliably known, I'm afraid. I've seen estimates as low as 10 and as high as 50 million. In his 1999 book, Humanity, A Moral History of the 20th Century, British philosopher and ethicist, non-Christian, Jonathan Glover, puts the figure at 30 million and reports Mao as having said, "We have so many people, we can afford to lose a few. What difference does it make?" For Pol Pot, we do know he killed around 2 million people out of a total population of 8 million people. Jonathan Glover concludes with these words: "The shared central project of the three regimes," he's talking about atheistic regimes at this point, "was the total redesign of society in ways unrestrained by human feelings or morality. Without these, people who did not fit the plan could be redesigned or eliminated." Now, I know that atheists try to wriggle out of this one by saying that whereas Christian atrocities were done in the name of Christ, atheist atrocities had nothing to do with atheism. I was going to give you a marvellous quote from David Bentley Hart. Can I also just say that you'll find a stack of John Lennox interviews on the CPX website, and one of them is on this very issue, and it's brilliant. He should be giving this talk. Fifthly, anyone can tell you that when Christians are violent and imperialistic, they are not obeying Jesus but defying him who said, "Love your enemy, do good to those who hate you." At best, friends, the criticism launched by Hitchens and Dawkins and co. only proves that Christians haven't been Christian enough. Believers confess that daily and seek Christ's help. The solution, therefore, is not less Christianity, but more. Let me quote from a truly brilliant essay by Yale philosopher Miroslav Volf. You've got to get your hands on this. I believe it is on the web. I can't remember where I got this. Most of the essay deals not with specific events in church history, but a larger philosophical critique of religion. Some sociologists and philosophers have made the case that notions like transcendence, monotheism, creation, eschatology, and atonement all can be linked to violence. And Miroslav Volf goes through and undoes it in a spectacular way. What a gift you have in this country in Miroslav Volf. Anyway, here's his point about the need for more Christianity, not less. When it comes to Christianity, the cure against religiously induced and legitimized violence is almost exactly the opposite of what an important intellectual current in the West since the Enlightenment has been suggesting. The cure is not less religion, but in a carefully qualified sense, more religion. I don't mean, of course, that the cure against violence lies in an increased religious zeal. Blind religious zeal is at the heart of the problem. Instead, it lies in stronger and more intelligent commitment to the faith as faith. In terms of how Christian faith is conceived, my thesis is this: the more we reduce Christian faith to vague religiosity, which serves primarily to energize, heal, and give meaning to the business of life, whose content is shaped by factors other than faith, such as national or economic interests, the worse off we will be. Inversely, the more the Christian faith matters to its adherents as faith, and the more they practice it as an ongoing tradition with strong ties to its origins and with clear cognitive and moral content, the better off we will be. And what about the brilliant non-Christian Albert Einstein, who saw that the problem was not Christianity, but precisely that Christians weren't adopting Christianity? Here is his from his 1915 essay, "My Opinion of the War," writing to German nationalists: "But why so many words when I can say it in one sentence, and in a sentence very appropriate for me as a Jew? Honour your master, Jesus Christ, not only in words and songs, but rather foremost in your deeds." Or in a letter to a German nationalist of 1918, "I prefer to string along with my countryman, Jesus Christ, whose doctrines you and your kind consider to be obsolete. Suffering is indeed more acceptable to me than resorting to violence." Sixthly, there is an awkward question that atheist critics have to face. It has to do with atheism's intellectual incapacity to restrain hatred and inspire love. Christians and atheists alike are capable of both love and hate. Agreed. But when a Christian loves, he or she does so in full accordance with a worldview rooted in the love of God. And when a Christian hates, she does so in direct opposition to a worldview rooted in the love of God. Here's the thing. What is there in the atheist's perspective that can restrain hate and promote love? I know that most atheists in the Christianized West choose love over hate. But if human beings are only accidents in an unknowing universe, how can this choice be anything more than a mere preference, as Bertrand Russell once famously confessed in his debate with Frederick Copleston? On what grounds can an atheist speak of a rational basis for ethics? Or put this way, only one kind of life is logically compatible with Christianity. Any kind of life is logically compatible with atheism. Yes, Christians have been wicked, but they have done so by defying Jesus. Yes, atheists have been wicked, and they have done so by defying nothing. If you want an account of this whole idea from a top of the tree philosopher, again, one of your precious jewels in this country, Nicholas Wolterstorff, again from Yale University. Justice, Rights and Wrongs, Nicholas Wolterstorff. This is a magisterial study, both of the origins of human rights language, which he clearly traces to medieval canon law as it reflects on the ancient Christian texts. It has almost nothing to do with Enlightenment values. And the evidence he lays out is just fantastic. But chapters 15 and 16 of this marvelous book, Justice, Rights and Wrongs, is a brilliant account of the fact that human rights cannot be grounded in a secular vision of the world, not rationally. I'm not just picking some crazy right-wing Christian apologist. This is top of the tree work. Let me close with what is the ultimate knockdown argument. You ready? The ultimate argument is, of course, not an argument, but a life. The godly life lived. Aristotle, in his book on persuasion, a textbook for 2,000 years, when he said, character is almost, so to speak, the controlling factor in persuasion. But why do we need Aristotle when we have Peter? Who is going to harm you if you are eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear, do not be frightened, but in your heart set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. Friends, this has never been more important. Yes, there are things we can say in response to the criticism that the Old Testament is violent, that the church is violent. But ultimately, the only way to win this argument is to offer a counter-narrative before your nation. When Americans hear from Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins and so on that the church is imperialistic and bigoted and warmongering and harsh and violent, and they see any hint of that in the church, they connect that tiny evidence with the big story that they've heard. But what I'm pleading you to do is to live such humble, generous, grace-filled, friend of sinners lives that when people hear Hitchens and Dawkins and the rest, they laugh. Because they can't square the story with the reality. May this be the case. Lord, please.
You've been listening to guest speaker Dr. John Dixon in a message titled Violence in the Old Testament. If you'd like to purchase a complete copy of Dr. Dixon's talk, simply call us at 1-800-448-6766 and ask for the program by name. That number once again is 1-800-448-6766. Or you can order online or listen to the broadcast again at rzim.org. And while you're there, we invite you to take a look at our three digital publications, all of which can be delivered right to your inbox. We offer a daily reading titled A Slice of Infinity, a monthly newsletter, and a quarterly magazine, which is also titled Just Thinking. Our JT magazine features regular articles from Ravi Zacharias and other members of the RZIM speaking team, each of which address timely topics and questions. Find out more at rzim.org. To contact us by mail or to make a donation, write to RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. Join us again next week as we hear more from apologist Ravi Zacharias. Let My People Think is a listener-supported radio ministry and is furnished by Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.